May it please the Court. Your Honors, we're here today because the respondent in this case is attempting to expand the statute of limitations. In this particular case, it's wrongful death, but in general, this application will have a far-reaching effect. They're attempting to expand the statute of limitations by the use of the John and or Jane Doe defendant concept. And then the second argument is attempting to utilize and apply Rule 5533 to this particular case. All the parties here agree, Your Honor, that the statute of limitations in this case ran on October 2nd, 2008. The decedent came into Barnes Jewish St. Peter's Hospital on October 2nd, 2005. She allegedly died as a result of malpractice or negligence that was committed sometime between October 1st and October 2nd. A lawsuit was filed timely against Barnes Jewish St. Peter's Hospital and Washington University.
But Washington University wasn't the employer of the doctors, as it turned out. Is that why they're out of the case now?
Yes, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. They then filed an amended petition in 2009, keeping the same defendants, same allegations. They then added in 2010, August 6th of 2010, they add not one, not two, but four new defendants. Three of the defendants I represent, and that's BC Missouri Emergency Physicians LLP, which was named in the petition as BC Missouri Physicians LLC. It doesn't really matter. David Pogemeyer, MD, an emergency room physician, and Scott Landry, MD, an emergency room physician. It's important for the court to understand that BC Missouri Emergency Physicians LLP is a separate complete entity. It is not part of Barnes Jewish Hospital. It is a third party that contracts with Barnes Jewish St. Peter's Hospital to provide emergency room physicians for the emergency room. So they are not under the umbrella of the hospital. The physicians are physician partners with the limited partnership. So they work in conjunction as independent contractors with the limited partnership. In this instance, when the petition was initially filed.
Oh, they so identified. I remember the case of Scott versus SSM. Besides the multiple use of caps, Scott versus SSM dealt with the agency between a radiology department that was independent contractor and St. Mary's Hospital. And the Court of Appeals at that time found that there was enough of a relationship that they were held in the case.
Yes, Your Honor, and we are not here on an agency argument. I'm sure that if this case had been filed with BC Missouri Emergency Physicians LLP, named as an original defendant back in 2005, timely, then we would be getting to that agency argument during the thrust of the case as to who is responsibility, do they have identifying markers in the emergency room to indicate to the public whether or not they're separate from the hospital. But that's a separate issue than what we're dealing with. What we're dealing with today is that none of these defendants, including Dr. Holzem, was named in the original petition. The case law that exists in this court concerning John Doe defendants is very limited in nature. There are two cases, Maddox versus Gardner, which allowed the use of John Doe defendants and allowed the statute of limitations to essentially expand when the properly identified and named defendants were added. The court's familiar with that case. It was an accident. They identified John Doe engineer, Rich Doe fireman. A subsequent case also utilizing the John and Jane Doe argument is Schultz versus, I'm going to mispronounce it, but Romanson. And in that particular case, they attempted to add doctors that had not previously been named. And the court in that instance, they had also used the Jane and John Doe defendants. The court in that instance said that that description, having no description at all as to the nature of the practice, where the medical practice was given, any indication that would put any of the individuals on notice was inadequate. In that instance, there was a slight twist, and the respondent in this case has tried to glom onto that it makes a difference, that the Jane and Don Doe defendants in that instance, when the new individuals...
But the treatment occurred October 1st and 2nd 2 days.
Correct,
so
Your Honor.
When they filed the action and they had named Jane and John Doe, and they cite the dates, and this person, as you said, allegedly died of malpractice, but I think she died anyway, but they died in the hospital in those days, because of the treatment in those 2 days, is it conceivable that the hospital could be on notice, whoever was involved in that treatment of that patient? You know who the patient is, and you know the dates they were treated.
No, Your Honor.
You know they died, and there's an action. You don't have any idea that there's...
No,
you
Your
might be involved?
No, Your Honor, because the description that the plaintiffs gave in their petition solely was defendants Jane and John Doe and defendants are providers of medical services who at all times relevant to this action was engaged in providing medical services to the consuming public, including decedent for a fee. There is no indication in that description as it relates to the Jane and John Doe defendants if the medical treatment was provided within the confines of Barnes Jewish St. Peter's Hospital walls, whether it was provided at a clinic, a walk-in clinic on the first that she may have gone to and then was referred to go to the emergency room, if it was by the EMS providers that took her to the emergency room, if it was by nursing staff on the floor, if it was by emergency room staff in the ER, if it was radiology, if it was a radiology issue, was there an x-ray? There's no description provided in the original petition or the amended petition that would give any of the three defendants that I represent any indication.
Is there any indication treating doctor, nurse, physician, anything
nothing
at all?
It says negligent in their treatment of the decedent, by and through such negligence caused the death of the decedent. So that was it in terms of what the description of what
yes
happened.
So if they had said, you know, John Doe, comma, emergency room physician at this hospital, comma, would that have been sufficient?
I believe, Your Honor, in all honesty, yes. Under the Maddox case, I think if there had been a more particular description as to who was performing the services, if the court would apply that court's rationale, that would provide some notice as to the nature of the care that was being performed.
If it said emergency room personnel, would that be too broad?
Emergency room personnel is too broad because that would include both the contracting physicians that are not part of the hospital as well as hospital-employed individuals and potentially outside staff nurses. At this point, Your Honor, if I may, I'd like to turn over the argument to Mr. Smith.
Thank you. Was your question fully answered, Judge?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
May it please the Court. It likely comes no surprise that I agree with Ms. Drew's arguments, and our briefs are similar, relying on similar precedent. And I would just like to point out that whether you take the analysis on the John Doe common law precedent that's been cited or whether you move on to Rule 5533C, both of those rules require that there's some type of notice, some pleading with such specificity that a person reading that petition can figure out that that they are the defendant that is meant to be sued.
So I don't have to get it before the statute runs because obviously there's a period of service. But if I'm able to see it, if I actually got it at some point or somebody told me about it, I'd know that it was me.
I think under Rule 5533C, if you were aware the lawsuit was filed within the statute of limitations and you could tell from the language, the description of the fictitious defendant in the pleading that they were talking about you, that would be sufficient. In this case, though, we know for a number of reasons that there was no specific intent to sue the named defendants that have been now added to the suit.
Was there anything in the record about somebody from the hospital after they were served with this coming around and talking to the people who were working that day and say, hey, did you see this woman named Alverna Katz, did you care for her? Did they look at their records to see who was involved with her care?
There's no evidence of that in the record, in Your Honor, and as has been pointed out in respondent's brief, this lawsuit wasn't filed until within 24 minutes of the expiration of the statute of limitations, so it would have been impossible for Dr. Pogemeyer, Dr. Holzman for...
No, but there's a period of time after the lawsuit's filed within which the time it's... You've got the case on file, and then there's a period of time after which you have time to serve it. So
correct.
It's not like you have to do it all in that 20 minutes. So you have a period of time between the time you get served. I mean, when the hospital got served, did they come around and say, "Hey,
no,
who did what? What do we know?"
Is it required that the petition give notice, or that are you required to do a subsequent investigation to figure out if what the petition says means you, or do you look at the petition to see if the notice is sufficient?
I think you take the petition on its on the language in the petition, and if the petition was described the defendants with specificity. So, as Ms. Drew said, if they said it was an ER attending physician, then that would be sufficient. With regard to my client,
the only thing, yeah, that's right. The only thing they know about this case is the name of the hospital, the name of the patient.
And that, it's a, and that it's a health care provider.
And a date.
And two dates, correct.
2 days.
And the patient died.
You pointed out, that, both of you, that there's two cases and there's also a rule. Both cases were decided prior to the rule. Do you argue that there's the rule in effect codifies the law as set out in those cases, or has the rule changed the law?
I think there's, I do not think that Rule 5533C codifies the common law about John Doe defendants.
Can both exist simultaneously, or has the rule replaced the cases in your view?
I think both can exist simultaneously.
But if anything, the rule for expansion seems more relevant today than in 1945. As was indicated by Ms. Drew quite well, there's a there's much more complexity in the healthcare profession now. I mean, there's different corporations, there's this, that. To create with specificity about who's done what, you really need either pre-filing discovery or something else. You can't really find out what the corporate relationships are. Whereas in 1945, you probably just had hospitals and doctors as opposed to corporations. So actually having specificity is much harder today in the complex legal arena of corporate structures than would have been in 1945.
Right. Well, I don't think that that's necessarily limited to the medical profession, but no. still, I don't think there's an exception to the statute of limitations that it was difficult to figure out who the defendant was, because if you adapt the rule that's espoused by plaintiff in this case, then with regard to, say, a products liability case, a mere pleading that there's a John Doe manufacturer who was someone who participated in the design, manufacture, sale, distribution of a product, and that's all you say, then that would preserve the statute of limitations. And every pleading would from now on include John Doe's 1 through 10, Jane Doe's 1 through 10, John Doe Corporation's 1 through 10, with a vague allegation that they were some type of tortfeasor in the case, and the statute of limitations would never expire.
May it please the Court. I think that the entire argument of my opposing counsel misses a point. I think the first thing we have to look at is whether or not the change from a John and Jane Doe defendant to the actual names of the parties intended to be sued is adding or changing a party or a misnomer. As this Court has said in two different cases, specifically, the first one was Watson v. Bliss. It says, amendment changing the party has to be distinguished from a misnomer. A misnomer or misdescription, however, was still not considered to be a change in a party and thus was still held to be governed simply by the requirements of the first sentence of Federal Rule 15C, now our 5533C.
But isn't there embodied in our case law the notion that the person who was in fact the defendant had some notice that but for the misnomer he was being sued?
Both the Watson case and the Bailey versus Innovative Management cases say that if it's a misnomer as opposed to adding or changing a party, no. There is no notice requirement. Only the first paragraph, the first sentence of Rule 5533C applies, and that is that if the amended petition arises out of what we used to call the same nucleus of operative fact or the same action, then it relates back. Only if you add or change a party do you get to paragraphs 2 and 3, or 1 and 2 under the second half of subpart
this
C?
This isn't a case where you didn't know the name of a corporation or you didn't know the proper name of the clinic or the partnership or so forth, which is what misnomer cases get to. This is you didn't know who it was, you didn't know who was negligent, you were incredibly industrious in filing in half an hour, and it's very impressive. So you didn't have a lot of information, you didn't know who to sue. It's not a misnomer.
Well, I agree with everything you said except for that it's not a misnomer. We knew that they were the physicians or other staff, and what both counsel said is true. We do this all the
time. You didn't say treating physician. You didn't say ER physician. You didn't say anesthesiologist or radiologist. You said all those people who treated them. That's not a misnomer, and it doesn't give anybody how could anyone know from that they're the one that's being sued?
Depends on how many people there are in that emergency room. In an emergency room such as BJC St. Peter's, there's no evidence of this, and that's the second half of my respondent's brief. There's no evidence of how big of a facility this is. From my own experience, which is not a record, there's one emergency room doctor there or two. This is not a big hospital. It's not a big enterprise. On the factual issue of what is reasonable notice, if notice is necessary, there's no evidence of that. I'll point out one other thing that no one has mentioned, and that is the Maddox case. That's a seminal case in this era, 1945. There is no place in the Maddox case where the court says notice is required. When they say that the plaintiff in the original petition called John Doe the engineer and Jane and Richard Rowe the fireman, they say that indicates the intention of the plaintiff to sue those people in those categories.
No, but they also say then you would know it was the engineer of that train, whatever that name was, and the fireman on that train, whatever that name was. Here it doesn't say the attending physician or the resident, you know, who was there that night in the ER. That would be the comparable situation.
A subtle difference. The Maddox case doesn't talk about notice anywhere. It's the Smith versus Lewis case, which for the first time says that Maddox meant there had to be notice. There is nothing. I challenge that.
There's a difference between notice and knowing from looking. I mean, because as Judge Wolf pointed out, of course, you don't find out about the suit till later, so you don't have to have known by the time the statute ran, but you have to know from looking at the petition that you're being sued. Otherwise, what's the point of ever giving names?
Well, and let me do by analogy the Ostermueller case. Ostermueller, this court decided in 1993 that we can sue somebody and never serve them, and the statute's preserved indefinitely. If they never get notice, and yet 10 years later, 20 years later, I can serve a summons on a defendant, and that statute has been told just by putting their name on a piece of paper that I file in the courthouse and never give anybody notice. If that's sufficient notice to draw them before the court, then identifying them, and what we said in the petition was, we said that they were health care providers, and that on or about October 1st through 2nd, 2005, the scene presented herself to defendants and through their negligent treatment died on October 2nd, 2005.
Again, how do we even know it's at the hospital as opposed to in an ambulance or at a clinic or at her doctor's office earlier or
because
anything?
I specifically, in the petition, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, go ahead, please.
We say that it's Barnes Jewish Hospital, Washington University, operating in the city of St. Louis, engaged in business providing an all-time issue through service and employees. Sorry, I'm going fast. But that we presented ourselves, the decedent presented herself to that entity at that time.
Okay.
We've got a specific hospital, a specific location, less than a 24-hour period in the real world, a small facility. We have no way of knowing. And by the way, as I say in my brief, I do this all the time. This is what I do for a living for the past 20-some years. When you sue, and by the way, under the concept of she represents three individuals, under Missouri law and the Health Care Act, both the new one and the old one, an employer and all of its employees, BJ Missouri Physicians LLC, Pogemeyer, all the different doctors that work for a BJ Missouri employer, whatever it's an emergency room corporation is, they're all a single entity under the law. In the old days when we got multiple caps, it was still a single cap for an employer and its employees. So that's a single entity. That's the Jane Doe entity. Okay. But these are not big, unlimited groups of people that have no way of knowing who they are. We sued a specific hospital for a specific event that happened on one day and all the people that provided health care. And we have no way of knowing because
when you file the lawsuit, you're spreading it upon the public record that a lawsuit has been filed. Whether a person served or not, there's still something in the public record. When they get served, they know that something's happened. And ostensibly, common sense would say you take the petition which they've been served, you take it to their lawyer, you take it to their manager, someone's going to look and say, who was involved here? What happened? And they should be able to discern what goes on there. You'd have to figure out what the different corporate entities are to be much more specific.
Absolutely, Judge. Much easier than we can. For example, in this case, as I pointed out in my statement of facts, after we filed the lawsuit, it took almost 2 years to get answers to interrogatories from Washington University, where they then misidentified the name of Ms. Drew's client. And that's why we sued it, once again, inaccurately, because even after 2 years of going through discovery, we still didn't get accurate information about the name of the entity. In these kinds of cases, it's often very difficult when you get the medical record, and say we had the luxury of time to have gotten the medical record ahead of time, and we'd look through it. Typically, the medical record is handwritten. Typically, the identity of the treating physicians, the nurses, the radiologists, etc., are written in by hand in a hurry. You can't read them. Typically, they're identified just by initials, which
they
don't
know. And
that's
what the misnomer exception is for.
Well,
but this is not that.
Well, it is, and I beg to differ. I think that under these circumstances, the only way to sue, under these unique circumstances, the only way that we could have brought the action and tried to obtain some justice for Ms. Katz is to sue in this manner. Because the purpose for these fictitious names, as the court pointed out in the Maddox case, is to, with the intent to sue the people that rendered negligent medical care to this deceased at this
specific So is there a laches issue? If you had found out about this 6 months before the statute ran, would there be a different requirement for how specific you have to be?
I don't think so, because it may take more than 6 months. In this case, it took us almost 2 years to find the appropriate names of the parties. It is a quagmire. I mean, we have a judge in St. Louis, Judge Durker, who wrote an opinion about the difficulty of knowing what medical billing means. It's a quagmire. You can't figure it out from the face of the documents. Medical records are the same way.
But, counsel, if you say under these circumstances that we should craft an opinion to give your client justice, but how will this be expanded and how can this be limited and not apply to broader situations and therefore be inequitable in those situations?
Well, I'll just quote from the Watson versus Blitz case. Back in 1986, this court said that we recognize that others have construed a misnomer, a misdescription, as a change in party under present rule of 15C. We do not agree with this interpretation. The misnomer theory existed long before the amendment of Rule 15C and our present Rule 5533C. The theory is still conceptually sound and unbalanced, not difficult to apply. In cases, for example, every case the opposing counsel cites where John Doe designations or misnomer has not been allowed is where there has not been a substitution of parties. In the Schultz versus Romanance case, they list a bunch of John Does. When they sued the correct parties, they did not remove any John Does. They had the same number of John and Jane Does and the new parties. That was considered to be an ad. In the Windshuffle case, which this court decided in 1983, once again, the John Doe was not replaced by any new party. In that case, I think it was Research Hospital. Stayed in the case. They added new parties.
Of course, John Doe was never served, I assume.
That's correct. Well, in that case, they served. Both the other cases that they cite, both as Windshuffle and the Goodkin case, there were defendants in the case that had been sued. The plaintiff later found out they were maybe the wrong defendants and added a new party. But in both the Windshuffle case and in Goodkin, the old party, the one that they were claiming was the wrong party, remained in the case after the new party was added. In the Schultz versus Romanes case, in Windshuffle, and in Goodkin, in all three of those cases, no parties were eliminated from the mix when the new parties were added in.
Can you address opposing counsel's analogy to the corporate situation, say products liability, where now you say the distributor and the manufacturer, and that would be sufficient then to stop the statute as to them?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is we've done that from time to time, and we've never had anybody complain of it because typically there's only one manufacturer of a given product. It's like that Stanley Botsis case that's in the record. At the time that the stapler was made or the nail gun was made, imprinted in the side of the nail gun, it said Bostitch, which had subsequently been purchased by Stanley and became Stanley Bostitch. We have done that on a regular basis where we name, maybe we know something about the manufacturer of the device. Sometimes we don't. Where all we know is the device and we don't know the manufacturer.
Well, and those, again, misnomers. If you have the name of the company wrong or successor, that's where those fit. But say you had, you know, the staple gun and those who put it in the stream of commerce, and then it takes a while to do research and figure out where it was sold and what distributor it went through and so forth and so on.
Well, and I guess the answer to that is that how is that different from suing a party that doesn't exist, and so the real party never gets notice, even if you've named something. Let's say I name the John Doe Corporation. And it turns out to be John Doe Corporation 2, which is a real defendant. And CT Corporation refuses to accept service of process on John Doe because they're no longer the registered agent for that entity. John Doe 2 never gets notice. But then later on, 5 years later, I find out the company that manufactured this device is really now called John Doe 2. For the first time, 2 years later, they get service of process, but it relates back. And it relates back because under the cases that have allowed relation back, when you correct a misnomer, the intent of the plaintiff was to sue that entity. It wasn't that we intended to sue some other than existing defendant.
Well, the real question, it seems to me, that we're addressing, or maybe we should address, is was an action commenced against these lawyers' clients? Because the statute of limitations says an action shall be commenced within 3 years. So the question is, what do we mean by commenced? I'll warn you about one other thing in terms of relying on the rule. This constitutional provision that authorizes us to make rules says that our rules may not abridge, modify, or expand any substantive law. And so it seems to me that the question is purely a question of statutory interpretation, or has the legislature somehow delegated to us under our rulemaking to decide when something's commenced? When was this action commenced against their clients, and what do we mean by commenced? And well, I'm going to ask them the same question, I think.
Well, this court has decided that issue twice, at least, as long ago as 1945 the Maddox case says that the action is commenced when you file the petition. And then definitively in Ostermuller back in 1993, this court held that an action is commenced for the purposes of the statute of limitations when the petition is filed. And as
right.
I say in my brief, if
that
I...
That begs the question, filed against whom?
Well, I had a valid petition filed against BJ, St. Peter's Hospital,
certainly,
Washington University, Jane Doe, and John Doe. Those defendants were all legitimately brought into the suit in a timely fashion. The only question then is, do their clients stand in the shoes of Jane and John Doe?
Right.
And as I was pointing out earlier, what the Maddox case says, and it doesn't say anything about notice to the new defendant, what it says is that it shows the intent of the plaintiff to bring action against these actual entities through fictitious names. And the use of fictitious names is specifically to preserve your right to bring in that party properly named when you learn of it. The other cases talk about the plaintiff suing the wrong party, a real thing in existence.
Where would be the authority for you to use a fictitious name?
Just case law. And that's what the Maddox case, that's what the defendant in the Maddox case said, that even if there were a statute, it would still not be proper, and there's no statute in Missouri. And the court said, as this court did later on in the Watson case, that this misnomer, this concept of being able to file fictitiously, extends way back before the rules, and it was always a part of common law.
Thank you. Let me follow up on that. I think, and this goes back to the question about whether these two rules can exist simultaneously as to the John Doe defendants in 5533C. And I think that's this example is why they can exist simultaneously. Was an action commenced against John Doe and Jane Doe in this case within the statute of limitations? Yes. Then the issue becomes, was John and Jane Doe sufficiently described under the case law regarding Doe defendants such that a person reading that petition could identify who John and Jane Doe were, and they can't. Therefore, the substitution is improper and should not be allowed. If you move on to Rule 5533C, that is the misnomer case, the amending of a petition, the adding of a party. And in those cases...
Could I interrupt you and go back? Why is it not enough information for you to know that if you were a healthcare provider of any level that treated the decedent on a particular day that you were sued?
Because let's take this case for example. This involves a hospital admission. And a hospital admission by its very nature involves healthcare providers at all levels, from a technician or a nurse's aide all the way to a brain surgeon potentially. There's radiologists, there's radiology technicians. And someone picking this up couldn't say, I'm talking about nurse B, I'm talking about the emergency room physician, I'm talking about the attending physician, I'm talking about the radiologist. If there were more specificity with the description of the individual health care provider, such as the admitting physician or the emergency room physician on this day, that I think would get there, but not in this case.
In this particular instance, if you prevail here on this, they still have a claim against the hospital.
That's correct.
Because I assume that in an emergency room situation, the hospital is an actor as opposed to just being a passive building where things happen.
Depending on whose care involved, sure. There are likely hospital employees involved in the emergency room care in this case.
But even your clients are acting on behalf of the hospital?
No, Your Honor. Not under the post-tort reform statutes, which require that a hospital can only be held vicariously liable for the actions of its actual employees versus just staff physicians.
But if your hospital is found liable for the death of Mrs. Katz, don't they then acquire an action against your clients?
No, I do not believe they do.
Not under the tort reform.
Not post-tort reform. And I think, and I'd like to just end with this statement, which I think demonstrates the fact that there was no actual specific intent to sue my client or Ms. Drew's client. And this is a statement from Respondent's brief on page 14, in which Respondent states that it was not known or knowable who provided care to decedent. Therefore, at the time the petition was filed, there was no specific intent to name any individual person, particularly our defendants, as the John or Jane Doe defendants in the case. Thank you.
Cases are taken under submission. The court-